this is Writers After Dark, and I'm your host, Summer Brooks. We are here because good stories start with the writers, because wherever there's a story, someone's either making it up or writing it down. And my guest today is author Daryl Gregory, whose novel Spoonbenders just came out in trade paperback. This is a fun one if you like capers, heists, and psychic abilities, at the very least. Daryl, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Summer. I appreciate it.
Now, this is a quirky story. It's a story about psychic abilities, con artists, and capers. And that's like three things that are, okay, wheelhouse, interested, and another wheelhouse. I don't even know if I can describe it without giving away the fun part. So you can try to do that for me.
Yeah. This has been pitched I remember when I was first talking to my agent about it, I'm like, you know, I've got this manuscript. It's kind of like the Royal Tannenbaums, but with psychics. And he goes, okay, let's see how that works. But it takes place in Chicago, where I grew up. And so and it takes place in the mid 90s, 1995, the summer of 1995. Mostly there's flashbacks to other stuff, Cold War, 1960s Psy war stuff that we actually funded, which is insane. But anyways, yeah, there's all this caper stuff because there's mobsters involved. There's long cons, short cons, magic tricks. And then people whose psychic powers don't always work or don't always help them very much. And the basic story is about they were called the Amazing Telemachus family. They were on the road in the 70s performing as sort of a psychic Von Trapp family, performing their feats. And then they get embarrassed on national television. And soon after that, the mom, who's the most powerful psychic in the family, she dies. She's a clairvoyant who can travel outside her body, and then the whole act falls apart and the family falls on hard times. And then we pick up 20 years later when Maddie, the grandson, who feels like he grew up after the circus left town, they had this amazing history, and he shows up and it's just his broke mom and his uncle, who's in debt to the mob, and his sort of con man grandfather. And he's like, what happened? Why did I miss everything? And then the novel opens with his power sort of erupting where he can travel outside of his body, and then hijinks ensue.
And the caper nature and the mob angle amused me because I'm a huge fan of the TV show Leverage. And okay. Leverage's spiritual grandfather, the show creator said, was the Rockford Files.
I love the Rockford Files.
These are shows that come up with a con or a scheme to get information or retrieve an object that was stolen from its rightful owner, sort of thing. And I was just like, this is right in that fun zone.
Yeah, I loved the Rockford Files growing up for some reason. And I hadn't made that connection before, but it's that kind of tone too with the mobsters where, with the whole family, really, there's kind of it's a little more heightened. If there's a situation where you could play up the tragedy or you could play up the comedy, I will always go for the comedy in that book. So the mobsters are frightening, except they're also a little cartoonish. Their toupees come off. They lose control. And that's definitely the kind of, like, you know, all the schemes that Jim Rockford's, his friend, Angel, like, was always getting involved in, those kind of things. So there's Frankie, the uncle, whose telekinesis only works when he's feeling really confident, and he never feels confident. is in debt to the mob, and he realizes that Maddie's power could help him see the combination of the safe that's holding all his money where he owes the mob, and he's got this scheme to try to get it back. And that's one of the main schemes running throughout the book. But there's you know, I sort of rotate point of view through the different family members. So each of them have their own sort of schemes going on, including Teddy Telemachus, the grandfather, who's a card sharp, a mechanic, and he has no power, but he's been able to run schemes his whole life.
Now, the story, when I saw the title, it immediately, I thought this was going to be all set in like the 50s, 60s, and 70s with, who was the guy, Kreskin, and the other guy who did the spoon tricks on TV?
Oh, yeah, Yuri Geller. Yuri Geller's quote is the epigraph in the beginning of the book. But watching these, especially Yuri Geller, he was basically using stage magic to convince people he had psychic powers and to bend spoons. And I just thought this was amazingly fun stuff. And he had these rules. He had all these explanations for why his powers wouldn't work all the time, especially when magicians were present who knew how he was doing his tricks. So he would say, you know, if there's negativity in the room, his powers won't work. And he would also say that, you know, only a magician's tricks work all the time. Since my tricks only work some of the time, that's proof that they're real. And I just thought, that's fantastic. So that became my rules for how psychic powers work in spoonbenders. They don't work when people are feeling negative. They don't work all the time. And I was like, thank you, Yuri Geller. It's like the rules for magic in this world.
So what was the spark that triggered the story in your mind and said, okay, yeah, these are the people I need to talk about?
You know, it's hard to track this down sometimes. You start with like these kernels of stories. Like I had this idea years ago where a guy who would be pissed off at Johnny Carson for ripping off his mind reading act. So Carnac the Magnificent was this Johnny Carson character who wore a turban and he could see into envelopes, mm-hmm. And then deliver the jokes. And then there's a little side story in Spoonbenders where Teddy Telemachus is mad because he taught a young Johnny Carson how to do this magic trick, and he feels like he's been ripped off ever since. So there was that's like a kernel of stuff. Growing up in Chicago, I was reading about growing up in the suburbs. I didn't realize how many mob hits were going on all around me. And my best friend in high school, I was talking to him after I wrote the book. I'm like, Mark, did you know all this mob stuff going on? I mean, you're Italian. I don't want to be stereotypical, but did you know anything about this? He goes, Daryl, my dad was in the mob. I'm like, what? He's like, where do you think we got all that property? Like the Ruvalos ran that part of the suburbs. And it's like, what? So I was just a naive idiot. But it's, you know, it's part of what I love. I love the city. So there's all these different things that come together when you're putting together a novel. And also all these, I came from a really quiet family. They're Southerners who came north for jobs in the 60s. So I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago, but my family was pretty quiet. But I would like stay overnight at my friend's house, and they had these families that would just yell at each other, and they would have these huge fights, and then they would be laughing and drinking. And I was so jealous. I'm like, why can't I live in one of those families? So I wanted to write about one of those bombastic families that I would hang out in their houses, just watching like a fly in the wall. And so all that sort of stuff, you know, you sort of throw it in the grab bag and hope you can make a novel out of it.
Well, you've picked a very interesting family to follow, and the story, like I said, it's a lot of fun. The magic and the not magic, and the hopefully this isn't too much of a spoiler, the faking of the faking it.
Right. I don't think that's spoiling it.
Just the shenanigans are intriguing and funny. They're funny, they're entertaining, they're like, oh, okay, I see why you did that there. That's okay, smart. That's okay, you got me there.
Well, right. And you know, the whole book like a magic trick. So you can do this thing as a writer, especially with the novel, is that it's like if you need to have a rabbit come out of the hat in act three, you can go put the rabbit in place in act one and hope nobody notices that you just put a rabbit there. And so I definitely wanted to be one of those kind of novels where, look, if you pay attention, every single thing that happens later is totally set up if you go back and read it again, or So it's sort of a fair play novel. Every single thing that gets mentioned that looks like a surprise later is, you know, is set up in the book. And I knew, well, and the one of the main mechanisms for that is Buddy. I think he's my favorite character in the book. He remembers the future just as he remembers the past, to the point where some mornings he doesn't know what day he's in, and he's got to assemble clues to figure out what part of his timeline he's in. And he's got these visions of when all of the future stops. He calls it Zap Day. And he remembers parts of it, but he doesn't remember other stuff. And so he's desperate to save the family. He knows that's the day the mobsters are coming, and he has to prepare for it. And so he's anxious throughout the entire story, trying to, you know, arrange things around the family and the house to make everything work out so everybody comes out okay. And so once I knew I had that kind of character, things that normally would be a crazy, stupid coincidence in another kind of novel that you would throw out become actually part of Buddy's plan. So everything is game for being part of Buddy's plan.
I never thought of it like that. Having the ability to see the future makes you so neurotic that you're trying to make sure certain things do happen but prevent disastrous things from happening. That actually could drive someone insane.
He's so worried throughout the book. And he's worried to the point where he barely speaks because he's afraid if he goes off script, he will hurt the future he's trying to make. And so everybody's like, what is Buddy thinking? He just looks like a big guy who barely talks, and nobody knows what's going on in his head. But inside, he's just a worried mess and afraid to talk. He's sort of trapped by the future.
Yeah, that's a level of neuroses. I could see most people just becoming paralyzed because of it. Just like, okay, I don't want to do anything because I'll mess it up. But if I don't do something, it can mess up anyway. Oh my God.
Oh yeah. Yeah. There's a line in there where Buddy thinks, you know, duty eats free will for breakfast. he's got a duty to his family. And and he's secretly holding the whole family together.
So how much research did you have to do to get the magic tricks you needed in order to know them well enough to make sure they looked like magic tricks?
Right. You know, I read a lot like across the book. You know, this is one of those novels where you start pulling on a thread and you realize there's another book you have to read and another book you have to read. So on one hand, there's books about the actual psychic research that we were funding. And one reason the book is set in 1995 is that's the year Congress finally said, you know what, we're going to stop funding psychic research. We just kept funding thousands and millions of dollars. And now all that stuff's been released online. The CIA released all the records, and you can search through all their records for Project Stargate, a real project that was going on, doing research on these folks. And Uri Geller was one of the subjects, and lots of other famous psychics, as well as lots of soldiers. They just sort of were trying to train up to do their clairvoyance so they could psychically spy on the Russians. That was their main thing they wanted to do. But they would also hold spoon bending parties. It was crazy. So there's all that research going on, as well as the Russian side of things. And I barely got to touch on the Russians program. But there's all that research going on. And then there's Uri Geller and the tricks he would use. And I owe a huge shout out to the amazing Randy. So he's a stage magician who debunked Uri Geller and spent his later career basically investigating psychics. And he doesn't like the term debunk. He says, look, I'm going in with an open mind, but I just know how magic works. So I would love to be proved wrong. But let's try to test these folks. And he had a $1 million prize that ran for years for any psychic who could demonstrate their abilities under just normal observable conditions, not through trickery. So I owe a lot to Amazing Randy, and I read several of his books on how psychics do their thing. And then Teddy Telemachus, who's a card sharp, I wanted to understand all the different ways that you can manipulate cards, manipulate a poker table, and do, you know, sort of sleight of hand magic. And even though I never got good at any of these tricks, I sort of worked my way through these books because I just found it really fascinating. So the whole breadth of fakes, people who are honest fakes who tell you, look, I'm going to do a magic trick and this is a trick. And then the dishonest fakes like Uri Geller, who claim that what they're doing is not a trick. One of the questions I get all the time is, so do you believe in these psychic powers? And I'm like, I'm sorry. I'm a skeptic. I would love if this stuff was true. But you read enough stage magic books and you realize, you know, every single thing that these psychics can do can be replicated. So there's got to be a higher bar. And my rule is if psychic powers really worked, Google and Facebook would all be using them. They would be monetizing them. And so because they failed to monetize them, it's not there yet.
I like that. It's like if people aren't making tens of millions of dollars on it, it's trickery.
Yeah, right. It's the greedy capitalism defense.
Okay, I will have to give you that one. That's hilarious because the when you're talking about the research and the reading, I'm like I said, I'm a big fan of the show Leverage, and they actually brought in a former thief who is a sleight of hand expert to teach some of their characters how to do the, you know, certain lifts and pickpocketing moves and whatever. And there's like a behind the scenes on one of the seasons. I don't remember if it was season one or season two on the DVDs where they're talking and Dean Devlin is saying, yeah, Apollo said that Beth got so good she could actually be a professional thief. Like the blonde the blonde who plays Parker in the series is supposed to be a thief, and he taught her these tricks and she became naturally good at them.
Oh, that's awesome.
And then was it Penn and Teller had a TV show on Sci-Fi Channel like, I don't know, 5 years ago or so, where they were, it was a competition between stage magicians. And the goal was to do your tricks in such a way that Penn and Teller couldn't tell what the trick was. You had to trick the master trickers. And anytime somebody right. did a card trick and they were impressed, you could tell, because there was, I remember one episode where Penn's going, that was amazing. There was this woman from Russia who did this wacky card trick. And he said, I couldn't tell what the trick was. That's impressive.
Yeah. So I think you're talking about Penn and Teller's Fool Us.
No, they had a show before Fool Us that was on Sci-Fi Channel.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Because I love Penn and Teller, both because they're sort of, you know, the meta magicians in that they not only are just top at their craft, but just their way of explaining a trick and still fooling you. Like I really took that to heart when I was writing Spoonbenders, where Teddy will say, look, there's a con going on and I do magic tricks, and then he would still do the magic trick and he would still fool people. And that's what you want in a book, where it's like, look, you know, this is fiction, you know, I'm making it up, you know, I'm lying to you, and you know, I'm trying to lie to you. And I just want you to be surprised anyways and entertained by it and, you know, thankful for being fooled. I mean, I think that's the difference between being an honest fake and a lying fake, is you're grateful when they pull it off. But I love Penn and Teller. They're fantastic.
Yeah, I just Google just told me what the show was. It was called Wizard Wars. It was a reality competition show where magicians or teams of magicians performed magic routines in front of a live audience, and they would be judged on the level of creativity, the level of deception, and the level of showmanship they displayed doing their tricks. And I think there was something where like it was like a sort of like a bracket competition where like the winner of the winners actually would get a show in Vegas.
Oh, that's awesome. I have to. All right, I'm gonna be looking that up.
It's not on anymore. I think it only ran like two or three seasons. Like, but I think it started around the same time Face Off did. I remember watching the first season of it, going, I had no idea this many people wanted to get into being stage magicians. It's just amazing. They had people from all over the world. There was like two different teams from Russia who were demigods with cards. It was just an amazing thing. I'm like, what the, how'd they do that? But so the, has your research into magic and trickery inspired the possibility of a sequel?
Well, I have two answers. One was they're trying to develop it into a TV show. And I was talking to the screenwriter. She's writing the scripts. And she said, well, what we're going to do is we're going to use Spoonbenders, the book, as basically season one, 10 episodes. And then we'll set up things for season two. And I said, could you tell me what happens in season two? Because that would save me a lot of time if I have to write a sequel. So they may have plans that are much more concrete than mine are. And for me, like I've had this idea in mind for a while to, skip ahead to the current day. So Maddie's grown up and see what happens to the family years on. And the first scene, I know what the first scene is. It's Teddy Telemachus' funeral, and it's Teddy's last big con gets paid off at his funeral. And so, but all I have really is the start of that and a couple ideas for where we'd go from there. But I'm not working on the sequel right now.
It's funny what you described the screenwriter, because that what the story that she's working on, there's a TV show that was on earlier this year called Deception. Did you see that? It was on CBS,
no.
I think. Yeah. There's this guy who's like a combination of David Blaine and David Copperfield. He's a huge, it's like Now You See Me only with one guy.
Okay.
And he's famous, and he has an identical twin brother who gets railroaded for a murder. And so he starts working with the cops in order to uncover clues that would help him prove his brother's innocence. And he's doing he's helping them break cases by doing tricks. I think the show's been canceled, so it was probably on for like 12 or 13 episodes, whatever it was. But the first couple episodes were interesting, and then it got kind of slow, so.
Right. Well, I grew up, there used to be, when I was a kid, there was a show called To Catch a Thief.
Oh, yeah.
where he was a stage magician and he would use his, trickery to catch people. And I've read about con men for years. I did like a book. I remember doing a book report like in fifth grade. And it was just old cons going back to the 1800s. And I thought, this is amazing. And I never had the guts to do any of them myself. And I was raised up in the church. So maybe my conscience would have got to me, or my fear. But I just always was entranced by just the level, the lengths that people would go to and the cleverness of it. And so I love, like, for instance, Better Call Saul, where he's the main character, a couple times pulls off a couple different cons. And I just thought, I just love these guys. I mean, in real life, they really hurt people and they take people's money and they're a little sociopathic. But on a charming TV show where they go against the bad guys, then you're on their side. And so it allows you to enjoy the con without feeling too bad about yourself.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, sometimes when you watch those schemes and those cons and you go, I'm glad these people are writing for television and not doing this for real life.
Right.
So what else, other than dreaming of Spoonbenders on TV, are you working on or thinking about working on?
Yeah. So, I've been teaching a lot, and mostly a lot of these people are writing short stories, and I began to feel guilty that I hadn't written a short story in a long time. So there's a novelette coming out from Tor.com in September. And then I'm working on a young adult series called Harrison Squared, which it's been delayed a couple times, so I'm not even going to tell people what year it's coming out. We're going to release all three books. It's sort of a Lovecraftian adventure story, and it's based about a character called Harrison Harrison, who was, as an adult embittered character, was in my novella We're All Completely Fine. And so I wanted to write about his childhood as a monster hunter. So that series is, I'm working on that, and working on scripts for video games, and then working on the next novel for adults, which has no title and is and in such a state I'm not even talking about it yet. But there's it's not a sequel to Spoonbenders, but the next adult novel I'm working on. So yeah, so I the tricky part during the day is to not hop projects too much and get nothing done. It's like, oh, today I should just focus on one of these things.
The Monster Hunter story has always fascinated me because I was wondering what happens when the Monster Hunter runs out of monsters to hunt? Because there's other Monster Hunters out there, you know, they're not the only one. And what if they actually hunted the monsters to extinction? What would they do? It's like they did
Right.
their job. They did their job. They did their job well. There are no more monsters. Now what?
Well, exactly. And so my guy's in therapy. And so We're All Completely Fine is a novella. That one's about all these people who are participants in various kinds of horror stories, different subgenres of horror, who all find themselves in small group therapy together. And then they realize that their stories are not only not over, but they're all interconnected. And one of the tropes I was messing with was, you know, there's the Joseph Campbell idea of the eternal hero who has the heroic journey. And there's a sort of a dark mirror of that with the way monsters work in horror stories, which is instead of the hero being called from the normal world into the mythic world to do an action and then returning home at the end. You know, the monsters come out of the dark and they enter the world and they get expelled again, but they always come back. Like one of the ongoing tropes of horror stories is that you can never kill evil. Evil always returns. And so I was interested in this idea of a sort of a mutating kind of thing where it keeps coming back in different forms over the years. And so that would be my answer if we were living in my universe, is that the monster heroes would think they were done, they would start to relax, and then all of it comes back again. That would, because you can never ever get rid of these monsters.
So it's like a comic book where the characters never really die.
Right. And you know, and that's a, you know, that's a problem with a lot of if people go too far into genre, like with comic books sometimes, it's like at the end of Infinity War with Avengers. It's like, well, no one really is really hurt by the deaths of half the universe because it seems like half the universe also is under contract for future movies. And so that these characters are coming back. And so there's something really liberating about genre novels that deal with the tropes, but also raise the stakes. And when you realize maybe they're not coming back or there's real damage and they just can't keep going. The therapy idea came from this idea that these guys who are these, you know, heroes of these horror stories, let's say you're an Encyclopedia Brown kind of kid, but you're dealing with monsters, and that's like really fun when they're writing it as a young adult or a middle grade book. But the psychic toll of being that guy and knowing that underneath the covers there's all this awfulness, there's all this evil under the covers. Would have its toll in therapy, and I was interested in what happens after the story is over. What kind of damage are they dealing with, and how do they even relate to humans, normal humans, who don't realize how messed up the world is? Of course, these days we all know how messed up the world is, so we're all in kind of a horror story right now. So
Yes. We are waiting for the real zombies to appear so we can start making use of our shotguns.
Well, yeah, you know, I wrote a zombie and sort of a anti-zombie novel called Raising Stony Mayhall, and it was about that idea, which is in the hero in the book, the hero is a zombie, and in my world, Night of the Living Dead was a documentary, and the one difference I made with the zombies is that after 48 hours or so, they stop being ravenous feeders, and they come to themselves, and a consciousness and awareness. But now they're all being hunted, right? So they have to go into hiding, and they're sort of an oppressed minority.
Oh my God.
And I was And they form support groups too. They sort of have enclaves, and they're trying. And some of them want to be radical, like we should just bite everybody at once, and then there'd be more of our people. And they call it the Big Bite. And then there's other people saying, no, we have to coexist with humans. And then, well, how long do we stay in hiding? And so they have these it's the most bizarre philosophical zombie novel. And at one point, I do the next zombie resurgence as a bullet list because everybody's seen the zombie apocalypse a couple dozen times now. So I just go through the bullet list. I'm like, look, here's everything that's happening right now. One. And then just step through, the steps of the apocalypse. But but one of the things that I talk about in that book is the attraction of the zombie novel is that it frees you up to ethically take action and do harm to people. Because if you think that they're the other and they're the monster, then anything's allowed. You play these zombie games, you can shoot as many people in the head as you want because they're monsters. And so there's something kind of really disturbing about that. And you see it in our society all the time that we're constantly, people are trying to turn other people into the other and to give them freedom to take whatever action they want. And so that struggle between being really frustrated and wanting to take action, but not giving yourself any excuses to dehumanize anyone. And that's why people also have robot enemies. So you can shoot as many robots as you want. We don't feel bad for the toaster. But there's something weird about, killing something in a human shape that genre gets away with that we should think about more, I think. And now I've made this a really deep conversation. I didn't mean that.
No, that's fine, because that's what science fiction is all about, making observations of the world we live in or want to live in, and taking into account the good, the bad, and the ugly, and the, oh my God, really, part of that story, of that world.
Right. No, it's one of the things that really attracted me to writing in science fiction and fantasy was I grew up, so I was an English major and I read the canon, but when it came time to write, I just was really attracted to science fiction because you can take those metaphors and make them concrete. You can say, look, let's just take this, let's just not say someone is like a zombie, let's take a zombie and let's extrapolate from there. Let's go forward from there and take it on its own terms and see what that does to your head. And so I've always been, that's the kind of stuff I love to read, and that's the kind of stuff I love to write.
Cool. So where can people find out more about you and what you like to read and watch on TV, and whether you're a Marvel fan or a DC fan?
Oh, I grew up in Marvel, and I'm sort of pleased that Marvel's making the better movies right now. I just watched Ant-Man and the Wasp, and it was great. So I'm at DarylGregory.com is my website. On Twitter, I'm Daryl Writer Guy, because there was another Daryl Gregory already out there. It was annoying. So I'm Daryl Writer Guy on Twitter and on Facebook. And I don't take enough pictures to be on Instagram. I'm on Instagram, but it's a very boring feed. Don't follow me there.
So you're more chatty on Twitter is what you're saying.
Twitter is like my main place. Like the website and the blog is sort of a placeholder for stuff about the book, links to buy, that kind of thing. So it's more like something I can link to from Twitter. And Twitter has gotten so dark sometimes that my main job on Twitter is to say amusing things and then get off, go write something.
My main thing on Twitter is to find new books, and over on Slice of Sci-Fi, I join in the live tweeting of some of my favorite shows that I'm watching, and I chat with the writers' rooms of those shows if they have their own Twitter account, and it's delicious. It's delicious. Yeah, the Expanse, the writers' room for the Expanse, those people are just instigators, connoisseur. Instigators. The writer's room for Black Lightning, they were entertaining. It's just, and then when you live tweet along with them, they are so responsive, and the folks for the Expanse are snarky, and I wonder sometimes if if the guys who co-wrote the books are in on that. They will actually tweet during the expanse, as you know, James S.A. Corey. But every now and then you get something in there like, okay, wait a minute. Did everybody read the books religiously on that show? Did they read all the books twice to catch that? How? What?
Well, I mean, and those guys are in the writer's room, and they're co-writing, and I'm really pleased that they got picked up by Amazon.
Oh,
It's a
yeah.
really smart show, and they deserve their success, and they're true SF people, and so it's always good when people who really love science fiction get to make their show and get to have that kind of exposure. So it's fantastic.
So hopefully someday we'll get to see you live tweeting along with episodes of Spoonbenders,
I know, right?
right?
Well, here the thing is that I've had lots of things optioned over the years and re-optioned, and and nothing has gotten to the screen yet. So I have hopes for Spoonbenders. It seems to be a good team. Paramount and Anonymous Content are working on it. I love the screenwriter, Nicole Beattie. But it's everything takes. Has really long odds to get to the screen. All the money has to come together, a team of people has to come together, a slot has to come available. And so, I'm happy that if something ever happens, but it's a I'm not counting those chicks until they hatch. But I would love to be watching my own show, and hopefully it would be great and not make me crawl away and hide.
Excellent. Well, I will direct people to go read the book so they can enjoy the original form of the story they may see on Netflix, 5 years from now.
Right.
But the book is enjoyable, and like I said, if you're like me and you're a fan of your science fiction and or fantasy and or horror mixed with a little bit of shenanigans in the con artist genre, or you're just a regular caper, a heist, just fun mixed in with your dark seriousness. This is a book you should check out, and we'll have links to where you can find Spoonbenders online, Amazon, and all your favorite retailers. Is there an audiobook?
There is, and it's a fantastic audiobook, if I have to say so. They got Ari Fliakos, who was Audible.com's narrator of the year. This book was an Audible.com book of the year, our editor's choice for the year. I hear from a ton of people who are mostly, who are listening to it on audiobook, and Ari did he did a really good job. So check that out. That's on Audible or through Amazon. You can find it, or anywhere that sells audiobooks.
Cool. Definitely. We'll check that out. Daryl, thank you for your time and
Oh,
chatting
thank you,
about
Summer. I really
this.
appreciate it.
No problem. No problem. And we'll have more Writers After Dark just after this. Hey, hope you guys enjoyed that interview as much as I did. Just chatting with him and the enthusiasm he has for this story and the characters he's created is downright infectious. So seriously, go check out the book if you hadn't already. There are links in the show notes on the website to the print copy, the ebook copy, and the audio. I am a little bit behind on getting up the review for the book, but eventually that should be on the website as well. I want to thank everyone for listening. If you have any questions or comments about this interview, this story, this book, or any of the other ones we've done so far, please feel free to call. The number is 602-635-6976, or you can send an email to summer@writersafterdark.com. Questions, comments, recommendations. And there's also a form on the website you can fill out if you're interested in doing the occasional book review now and again for Writers After Dark. I am entertaining offers for reviewers. I've got ebooks, audiobooks, comics, all these Star Wars audiobooks. No one to take a shot at them anymore. So too many books, not enough time. And good ones too. Really, really good ones. You can listen to Writers After Dark on iTunes, on Stitcher, on Google Play, and you can leave a review for Writers After Dark on iTunes, on Stitcher, and I think on Google Play. I'm not sure about that, but definitely the iTunes review helps out a lot with potential listeners who haven't checked out the show yet. You can follow us on Twitter, Write After Dark. There will eventually be a writers and authors discussion and interview section on the YouTube channel, which you can find under Slice of Sci-Fi. For everything else, commenting on reviews we've already done, there's always the website, writersafterdark.com. I'd like to thank everyone who is supporting Writers After Dark and Slice of Sci-Fi through Patreon. Your donations do help keep the lights on around here, so thank you very much. If you'd like to add your support, the place to go is patreon.com/sliceofscifi. Thank you so much for those of you who are already supporting, and thank you in advance to those who consider joining the fun. I'd like to send a shout out to Shadon for facilitating the music you hear on the show. It is Archaics by Cybin Quest featuring Shadon, and we have links to their music on the website. But that'll do it for this episode. See you next time, and remember, keep looking for your own stories.